be seated.
All right. The first case for oral argument this morning is Daniel Neil Charles, appellant versus the state of South Dakota, appellee. For the appellant, we have, we have Miss Alicia, I'm not going to do well on this one, D. Edrick. Okay. All right. And we have Mr. Brad Schreiber. And and third gentleman?
John
Dole. Okay. And who will be presenting this morning? Okay, thank you. And then for the state, we have Ms. Ann Meyer, an assistant attorney general. And with that, you have 20 minutes, counsel, and you may proceed.
Good morning. And thank you for inviting us to present argument today. May it please the court. My name is Alicia Daddario, and along with John Dalton and Brad Schreiber, I represent the appellant, Daniel Charles, who is appealing the order of the Meade County Circuit Court, resentencing him to 92 years. Daniel Charles was originally sentenced to a mandatory sentence of life without parole for an offense when he was only 14 years old. Because of the United States Supreme Court's decision in Miller versus Alabama, which held such sentences are unconstitutional, Daniel had to be resentenced in compliance with Miller. And Miller requires that when sentencing juvenile offenders, courts must consider youth and its attendant circumstances and the ways in which youth counsels against lengthy adult sentences. And that what the Supreme Court has said is that in the vast majority of cases, when youth is considered, the appropriate sentence is going to be one that provides a meaningful opportunity for release.
Do you focus on the defendant or your client at the time the crime was committed, or do you focus on what he or she is now? In other words, do you consider their conduct in prison since the original sentencing?
Yes, I think both have to be considered. I think neither can be considered in isolation. But the trial judge in this case really failed to comply with the mandate of Miller. He imposed a sentence of 92 years, and in doing so, while he acknowledged what Miller has said about youth, he then refused to apply those mitigating qualities of youth to this case. And what he said was, and I'll just quote it briefly, this court accepts these principles in general to youth, but Miller does not stand for the proposition that these generally observed characteristics of youth are universally applicable to each and every juvenile. And that is simply incorrect. Miller does stand for the proposition that any time a juvenile is being sentenced, the mitigating qualities of youth have to be considered. It specifically applied that to children who commit murder. That's what the Miller case was about. And the court said that is not crime specific. That is a direct quote from page 2465 of the opinion. And in every case involving a juvenile, but especially a case involving a 14-year-old, the judge must take into account the Miller factors. But the judge here, when he went on to talk about the reasons for Daniel's sentence, he only mentioned youth just to discount it. He never gave it the kind of significant mitigating weight that Miller requires. In fact, the undisputed evidence was that these mitigating factors applied in this case, but that those characteristics were particularly strong because Daniel was only 14, one of the very youngest kids impacted by the Miller decision. And he was even less mature than the average 14-year-old because of his chaotic and traumatic background. That was the testimony of both the state and the defense experts in this case. And the state conceded in closing argument the characteristics of youth applied in this case. Even despite that, the judge refused to consider them.
Now, since he got a term of years, be eligible for parole at some point. Do we consider, when we look at the sentence, do we can look at the parole eligible date or the 92 years?
I think you can consider both, and you certainly can consider the parole eligibility date. But we do contend that sentence denies Daniel any meaningful opportunity for release. Even if he had some technical possibility of release, it's clear this would be at the very high end of sentences that would be permitted for a juvenile. And so in that sense, the consideration of youth under Miller is particularly important. And the more recent decision from the United States Supreme Court in Montgomery, which does a significant amount to clarify what Miller means, it really makes clear that Miller wasn't talking about some kind of technical consideration of age. The fact that the judge mentions age is not enough to comply with Miller. And the Supreme Court says, you know, very specifically in Montgomery, and this is at page 734, that Miller didn't just require consideration of age. It established that the penological justifications for denying release collapse in light of the distinctive attributes of youth.
So are you seeking relief in the form of a resentence?
Yes. We would ask the remand for resentencing where youth is appropriately weighed as a mitigating circumstance. And age really has to inform the way that everything about the sentence is considered. Instead, what the judge here did, he based the sentence primarily on two things. He focused on the need for retribution because he found this was a premeditated crime, and the need for incapacitation because he found that Daniels demonstrated continuing violence in prison. And neither of those are legally sufficient to override the constitutional significance of youth in this case. First, his findings about the crime. Miller teaches that premeditation means something different for a 14-year-old than it does for a 40-year-old. Their capacity to premeditate is just different. Premeditation, we find that aggravating, I think, because it implies a calculation of gains and losses and a decision to kill really in spite of that. That's exactly the kind of judgment that teens' undeveloped brains are not as good at making. And so applying the adult concept of premeditation to a 14-year-old is another way in which the judge really failed to comply with Miller and give youth the kind of weight that it requires. And more fundamentally, even assuming that factually the judge's findings about the crime are correct, Miller stands for the proposition that even when a youth commits a heinous crime, that in and of itself does not outweigh and can't be permitted to overwhelm those mitigating qualities of youth. And then turning to the judge's finding that Daniel demonstrated continuing violence in prison, that is simply contradicted by the record. The undisputed evidence was that his prison record is devoid of violence. He has no disciplinaries for assaults on staff, no disciplinaries for assaults on inmates, no disciplinaries for gang activity. The only even potentially violent incidents in his record are from when he was 15 years old. And first arrived in an adult prison. And even the state's expert testifies those were reactive to a threat and were not sort of instances of aggression. And that is actually a remarkable and extremely unusual record for a teenager who's put in adult prison. Generally, when teens go to adult prison, they do struggle initially. But Daniel has shown a commitment not to engage in violence. I think that really speaks volumes about his commitment not to be a violent person, even in a violent environment. And so I think the trial judge's finding in that regard is clearly erroneous. And I think that finding, again, goes to the Miller factors. It is very relevant to his capacity for rehabilitation, which is a critical factor under Miller. And so the sentencing in this case really completely failed to comply with Miller's mandate and Miller's requirement to consider age. And
now, I realize you're an appellate attorney, but if you represented this client on a resentencing, what kind of a sentence would you argue for?
Well, Your Honor, we represented him at the resentencing, and we did argue that a sentence of 35 years would be appropriate. Okay. I think a sentence that would provide a meaningful opportunity for release at a minimum is required. And that did not happen here.
All right. When you are talking about meaningful opportunity for release, is your interpretation that the opportunity for release is meaningful, or it seemed in your briefing you were talking about meaningful life afterwards? Which is your argument?
Well, I think for the opportunity to be meaningful, you have to have some meaningful life afterwards. Here, Daniel has no possibility of release until for 46 years or until he's age 60. And this court acknowledged in Springer that a term of your sentence could be so lengthy that it's equivalent to life without parole. And then looking at the United States Supreme Court's case law in this area, they've talked about a sentence that's equivalent to life without parole if it doesn't provide a meaningful opportunity for release or some hope for life outside prison. And the majority of courts that have addressed this have said that a possibility of release, basically when you're approaching retirement age, is not meaningful. And that to be meaningful, release has to come at a time when efforts towards maturity and rehabilitation can be recognized, and when the juvenile offender can still make some real contribution to society outside of prison. And the possibility of geriatric release, which is essentially what this would be, is not really responsive to the concerns about juvenile status that the Supreme Court recognized in Miller. And that's why...
In Miller, is it talking about the right to... It talks about murder cases or non-capital cases, does it not? And this is a capital case.
So the Miller decision is directed to capital cases. Both of those cases were capital cases. The Graham decision maybe was directed to non-homicide cases. But courts have found and then the Montgomery decision, again, was about capital cases and does invoke this language of if a juvenile is not sort of irretrievably depraved, and the state's conceded there's no finding of that here, then there has to be some hope for life outside prison, is the language they use in Montgomery. And I think that means something more than geriatric release. It means something that's really responsive to juvenile status and the ways in which children can change and be rehabilitated. So that's why I think the Wyoming Supreme Court found in the Bear Cloud case that parole after 45 years is not meaningful. And numerous other courts that we've cited in our brief, the Connecticut Supreme Court, the Iowa Supreme Court, have found that similar sentences are not meaningful. And we believe that this court should reach the same result in this case. And one of the things that courts have looked to in determining what a meaningful opportunity for release means has been the enactment of state legislatures. And I think when you look around the country, most of the state legislatures that have set when folks should come up for review have set that sometime between 20 and 30 years. And so I think that provides a useful guide in determining what's a meaningful opportunity for release.
So is that a decision we should make, or should our legislature be looking at that?
I think that this court has to look at it as well. I think the legislature certainly can look at it. But I think this court has to determine what's a meaningful opportunity for release. And here, Daniel needs to be provided with a meaningful opportunity for release, and that has not happened in this case. And I just briefly want to touch on the fact that the question is really not whether this is technically within his life expectancy. Again, it's about a meaningful opportunity for release. It's not some potential for release before death. And it's not at all clear the sentence is within his life expectancy because of the ways in which spending decades in adult prison from the time you're a teen likely would shorten your life expectancy. And we've cited one study in our brief on that. But again, I think that life expectancy is not what this court should focus on. The question is if it's a meaningful possibility of release.
When we look at, it's one question whether if he's paroled at 60, presumably he'll be breathing and living. But do we also look at his ability to adapt to the outside life after spending virtually his entire life in prison?
Yes, I think that's definitely something that the court could consider in determining if this is a meaningful opportunity for release. And again, I think it's not actually that clear that he would definitely be living and breathing. The one study we cited found that life expectancy for someone sentenced to life as a teen is about age 50. And so it's not at all clear, I think, that he would live to be 60. But even if we assume that he would, I think it has to be more than that. It has to be a meaningful opportunity for release, not an opportunity to be released and then die shortly thereafter. But I do want to be clear, I don't think that this court needs to find necessarily that this is equivalent to a life without parole sentence to rule in this case either that the judge failed to comply with Miller or that the sentence is disproportionate. But I think the fact that it is virtually a life sentence further supports why the sentence in this case is unconstitutional. And if there are no further questions on that, I will turn briefly to why this, we believe the sentence is disproportionate. And we think it's disproportionate both for a 14-year-old, for any 14-year-old, to receive a sentence of 92 years, and under the facts of this case. And as the Supreme Court recognized in Solemn versus Helm, proportionality is really central to the Eighth Amendment's guarantee of against cruel and unusual punishment. And the court has applied that proportionality principle in cases involving children in Roper, Graham, Miller, and Montgomery. And in each of those cases, the court found that the characteristics of youth are at the heart of the Eighth Amendment analysis in cases involving children. So in a typical adult case, when confronted with the question of disproportionality, this court would conduct a threshold inquiry, comparing the severity of the crime and comparing that to the length of the sentence. That kind of analysis really makes age irrelevant. And in Miller, the Supreme Court explicitly rejected that analysis. The state had relied on the Harmelin decision, which is what sets out that analysis, and the court explicitly rejected that. They said that the characteristics of youth can themselves render a sentence disproportionate. And then again, in the Montgomery decision, the court reaffirmed that even when age is taken into account, a sentence for a child can still be unconstitutionally excessive. And in fact, in all but the rare extreme case, a lifelong adult sentence will be disproportionate when imposed on a child. And under that analysis, when Daniel's extremely young age is taken into account, the sentence in this case is disproportionate. 14-year-olds are among a small handful of the very youngest children impacted by Miller. 98% of the juveniles who've been sentenced to life without parole in this country are older than 14. And a 14-year-old is at the very beginning of the adolescent period. The way adolescent development works is that 14-year-old's capacity to problem solve, to do all the things that Miller talks about, is different from a 17-year-old who is that much further along in their development. 14-year-olds are often still in middle school, haven't even started high school yet. They're barred by law from many of the rights and responsibilities that we trust older teens with. They can't consent to sexual activity. Older teens can. They can't get married even with parental permission. Older teens can. They're not even allowed to donate blood, which older teens are allowed to do. And this court recognized in the Menders case that 14-year-olds need special protections, that they can be particularly vulnerable, impressionable, and subject to making ill-informed choices. Because of all of those vulnerabilities, a 92-year sentence, which is the longest sentence given to any juvenile in South Dakota, is excessive for a 14-year-old. You simply can't say that 14-year-olds fall into that rare category that would justify a sentence of this length. And then it's also excessive for this particular 14-year-old, given everything that we know about his background and the events leading up to this offense. I think there might be some dispute on the specific facts. There was really no dispute below that Daniel had a chaotic and traumatic childhood, and that because of that, he was even less mature than the average 14-year-old. Daniel had been repeatedly abandoned by his mother over and over throughout his childhood. He'd been subjected to physical and emotional abuse for a number of years. Despite all that, he had no prior involvement in the justice system. And since he's been incarcerated, he's earned his GED and a certification in Braille transcription. And while his prison record isn't perfect, it's devoid of any violent behavior, and it's steadily improved over time. And so under those facts, this is not one of the extreme worst of the worst cases that would make this kind of extremely lengthy sentence proportionate for a juvenile offender. Again, this is the longest sentence given to any juvenile in South Dakota. The other two kids who've been resentenced under Miller have both received sentences that make them parole eligible after 20 or 25 years, even though those were also very aggravated crimes. And I think this is also extreme compared to other juveniles around the country. As I mentioned before, following Miller, many states have adopted remedies that permit juveniles to have some possibility of release after 20 or 30 years, even in the most aggravated cases.
And so, counsel, you represented Charles at sentencing. You asked for a 35-year sentence. What would be his parole eligibility?
On 35 years, he'd be parole eligible after half, so after 17 and a half years.
So he'd walk because he's been in jail since 2000, right?
No, he would still have a little bit of time to do on that.
All right.
But he would be parole eligible soon. But certainly what we're asking this court to find is that he has to be given a meaningful opportunity for release. And that would mean parole eligibility somewhere between 20 and 30 years. And so he would still have a significant amount of time to do on such a sentence. But that would be a constitutional sentence in this case, which is what we would ask this court to require. So if there are no further questions, we believe this sentence is unconstitutional.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Ms. Meyer, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court. This judge reviewed the...
Please. You ready to go? We had to get the clock set. Sorry.
Oh, sorry.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Okay. Well, I'll start again. Are you ready? Okay. When the court looked at this case below, he was not taking everything into account in a superficial way. He looked at it through the lens of Miller. He looked at all the different circumstances, including the fact that Daniel had a difficult childhood. Age was important. This entire proceeding was permeated by age, from the procedural part where we came back down for the resentencing hearing and throughout his analysis, and they didn't put any statistics in so the court could see what Daniel's life expectancy was. But the court may not have said anything perfect, but few of us do, and perfect eloquence isn't required. He obviously was concerned about the defendant's 14-year-old age, and he listened to three mental health experts who talked about his age and his upbringing and all the factors that were going on at the time of the crime. But Judge Eckridge has to protect not only the defendant, but also society and the victim's family. And what he looked at was that this was a premeditated, intentional sniper killing, that the defendant intended to do this. This wasn't an impulsive event. He had threatened his father or stepfather before. He dry-fired a rifle at his parents when they were fighting. He was not just acting on impulse. He came back to the house. He removed the window very carefully in the farmhouse. He lay in wait, and he he blew his stepfather's head off with a deer rifle. He had other options. He could have driven away. He had a vehicle. He knew how to operate a complex fire machinery, and he recanted when he was talking to Dr. Kaufman, our expert. He admitted that he had deliberately shot his stepfather. And Dr. Kaufman, who's a very conscientious man, took into consideration that fact and the fact that Daniel has continuing problems managing his anger and his temperament. He hasn't exactly had a completely perfect time in prison. He has had some violence when he's in there. He threw a wheelchair at a supervisor and lost his job. He hasn't been able to hold a job. He keeps getting in trouble for doing things that are wrong. He's had prior assaults, and he had some peripheral involvement in providing information for an escape. So he hasn't had a perfect record in prison either. And all those factors, the court looked at all of those things. This was a meaningful Miller v. Alabama resentencing hearing. And the fact that the defense is not happy with the sentence that they got does not mean that age and all these factors weren't taken into consideration. And the court was very careful to say that he was looking at everything and he was concerned about protecting society too. If there are no questions on the Miller v. Alabama aspect, I'll just briefly touch on...
I have a question. Do you think that we or the legislature should fashion some kind of a bright line rule, 20 to 30 years in
no,
a situation like this?
Not at all, because if you look at Diaz, it's a matter of drawing the line in every individual case. We are walking the Eighth Amendment line until the Supreme Court tells us otherwise. Our legislature has taken life and death off the table for juveniles, and this court was walking the line, giving a term of year sentence so that this juvenile has the opportunity for parole at 60. He has to prove himself. That's what Montgomery says. Montgomery says that we're not upending state parole systems. It says that it's incumbent upon the juvenile to get there. Springer was a very instructional case. It tells you that it defines what a de facto life sentence is, and it tells you that this court is leaving that open. But if you have the opportunity for release within your natural lifetime, and I do have to say this, based on what our expert's opinion reflects, Daniel didn't have any health problems. He's a 6'4" guy. He weighs 260 pounds. His only complaint was he wanted to lose 20 pounds, and he was having some chronic sleep difficulties. There's nothing in this record that indicates that he's going to die in prison or die before 60. That's a gross overstatement, and I don't think the court had any way to judge that in terms of statistics, nor does this court on appeal. So I hope that answers your question. And just briefly moving on to the disproportionate sentence, recently this court rendered the opinion in Diaz and talked about the two parts that we have to look at in terms of the test. One is the gravity and one is the harshness of this offense. And the court said that first-degree murder is, of course, at the higher end of the spectrum, taking a human life, which is what happened here. Someone lost their life, and this was a cold-hearted murder. This youngster took someone's life, and there should be retribution for that. This family demands it, and so does the society. And in terms of the harshness, you're required to consider, as the Diaz case says, parole, and he has that chance. It's on Daniel's head to show that he can make it now. He's got light at the end of the tunnel. And as far as geriatric release, some courts are looking at this in terms of quality of life. Some are looking at it, as the Nebraska Supreme Court does in Cardhelyak, in terms of quality of life. But this court is looking at it in terms of a glimmer of hope, and that's what Daniel has. If there are no other questions, I'll just conclude my remarks. Thank you. We'd ask that you affirm this sentence.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Counsel, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll just briefly want to address some of the facts that were mentioned by opposing counsel. First, she said that he was 14. He could have driven away to get out of this situation. He's 14. He doesn't have a driver's license.
Just a question. Now, you say various things the judge did not consider, mm-hmm. but I take it since you were his sentencing counsel, you made those arguments, so the judge was at least aware of what you thought the law was.
Yes, we made those arguments. We submitted a pre-hearing sentencing memorandum where we cited cases explaining that what a meaningful opportunity for release would be. And so we have raised all these issues. But I think when you look at the sentencing and what the judge did, it's I think, a very fair reading that he did not apply those mitigating qualities to this case. And I think when the state explains the things that he relied on, I think those are the things that the court relied on and that he did not take into account the mitigating qualities of youth. As a 14-year-old, he did have much more limited ability to escape from this situation. That's exactly one of the mitigating qualities of youth that should be taken into account. He didn't have a driver's license. He couldn't just drive away. He'd immediately be pulled over. I think, again, the fact that he's recanted his trial testimony and is now taking responsibility for this offense, I think that shows maturity. That shows the prospect for rehabilitation. And I think is not something that should be appropriately weighed against him, that he wasn't honest as a 14-year-old. That's what we expect kids to do. Kids lie to try to get out of trouble. That's one of the things that kids do. The fact he's not doing that now, I think, speaks positively about him. And then opposing counsel said that the testimony was that he has no health problems. That's not correct. The state's expert said that he had not taken into account all of Daniel's health problems, but he was aware that he had additional health problems. And then you mentioned this incident where he threw a wheelchair. There's no testimony that he threw this part at anybody, at any person. He was angry, and this testimony of the state's expert was that incident was several years ago, that there were no incidents in the last several years in which he had acted out in anger in that way. And that is at page 99 of the transcript. And then just a couple quick points on the law. I want to address this question of line drawing and whether this court should draw a line. I think this court does have to draw a line at some point. It's true that anytime you draw a line, that can feel somewhat arbitrary, that some cases will be over the line and some cases will be under the line. I think that's similar to the Miller decision, which draws a line at age 18. It may seem somewhat arbitrary that, you know, if you're a few days before your 18th birthday, you can't get the death penalty, you're very limited in your exposure to life without parole, and that if you're a few days after, you are exposed to those penalties. But we have to draw the line somewhere. And I think that this sentence is over the line. We recognize the Diaz case, which found that 40 years was not over that line, and the Springer case, which found 33 years was not over that line. We think this case is. This case goes beyond what any state legislature has set as that meaningful opportunity for release, and is in line with what other courts have found does not provide a meaningful opportunity for release, in the Bear Cloud case, Cassiano case that we've cited in our briefs. And I don't think that the Supreme Court has told this court already, not just life without parole, but that there has to be a meaningful opportunity for release. And so I don't think that this court needs to wait for further direction from the Supreme Court before recognizing that. Most courts around the country that have looked at this question have found a term of years can still violate Miller, can fail to provide a meaningful opportunity for release, and have found sentences in this range don't provide that meaningful opportunity for release. And then finally, on disproportionality, as I mentioned earlier, the threshold inquiry where you compare the gravity of the offense to the harshness of the sentence doesn't apply in cases involving children. The analysis that has to be applied is the analysis of the Supreme Court in Roper and Graham and Miller and Montgomery, where this court would look to the ways in which the qualities of youth impact the justifications for the sentence. And consider objective indicia of what appropriate sentence for a youth under these circumstances would be. And I think that's when this court can look to legislative enactments around the country and to the other sentences that have been imposed for youth. And if there are no further questions, we'd ask this court to reverse and remand for resentencing. Okay.
Thank you, counsel. We got done a little early today in this argument. We do schedule cases on the hour because they're live on the internet. So rather than a 10-minute break, we'll be in recess until 10 o'clock and then proceed with our next case. We're in recess until that time.